again, if you weren't here a minute ago, we're in Luke chapter 19. I'm going to be reading out of the Christian Standard Bible today. If you like to follow along in the translation I use, we do have black colored Bibles at the back of the room and some baskets on the floor. Feel free to go grab those. By the way, Luke has given us really a fantastic narrative description in today's text. It's really ripe with meaning and truth. Should we slow down and pay attention to what's said and how it is said? The Lucan text, when I say Lucan, I mean the text that Luke wrote, seems to be forcing us to slow down. In fact, because over the last several passages, we've seen the words about him drawing near to Jerusalem. And so you say it so many times, you think, okay, is he going to get there? You know, he keeps drawing near. But it's doing it in such a way as to show you it's slowing it down, kind of like a replay of a sports play in a game that's slow-mo. It's trying to get us to slow down and pay attention to what he's saying. Luke was a master of words. He was a master of the Greek language and probably a lot of what encompassed the Greek language and grammar and the way you say things, how you say it, were probably things that he took time to consider and think through. And by the way, while not always the case, this passage not only tells of actual concrete events, there are also spiritual realities being conveyed simultaneously. That's what I mean by the uniqueness of Luke and his writing. He could write about a concrete activity, but there's also another simultaneous parallel message being spoken about in his text. So let's keep that in mind as we look at this brief passage. But before we do, it's probably important to give some context to the text because we're only going through four verses today, and so we don't want to break it from its context. The first thing I need to mention, if you're unfamiliar with the Bible, this comes in the Luke text where Jesus is approaching Jerusalem after what's called the triumphal entry. Some of your Bibles will actually have that as something of a heading a few passages before the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. This is the event from which we celebrate the beginning of Holy Week, which starts on Palm Sunday and ends with Resurrection Sunday or Easter Sunday. And so what we're going to be celebrating here in April, we're seeing the events unfold that lead to why we celebrate the events starting on Palm Sunday through all the way to Resurrection Sunday, the next Sunday. And so that's where this finds itself in the passage. He's just received the Palm Sunday events of them laying palms, singing praises to him as he begins the process of entering Jerusalem. The religious leaders of the day don't like how they're treating Jesus. They are treating Jesus as if he's God, which he is. But yet they think that's heretical. And so they say, hey, tell your followers to stop treating you like God. And Jesus' response in verse 40 says, I tell you, if they were to keep silent, the stones would cry out themselves. He says, we should not silence them for doing what is actually right. Now, that's going to have an interesting, that's going to be an interesting statement, the way he said that regarding the stones here in just a minute. But anyway, that's what's happening here. But there's something else to the context that we also need to understand, and that is what happens afterwards. And I hope you'll understand why I'm detailing what happens afterwards. What follows is he clears the temple out. And not just in any way. He clears it out in the most dramatic and some would say even violent way. Clearing tables, throwing out the money changers, going about, he even created a whip to get those who were treating it as he said, like a den of robbers to get them to cease those activities and to leave the premises. So that happens. And by the way, we're not going to get into those texts, but just so that you understand, when he clears the temple, when he calls it a den of robbers, he's basically saying, you religious leaders are using this as something of a hideout from the rest of the world. A hideout, and you're hiding the greatest message that could ever be told, and that is not the purpose of the temple complex. The purpose of the temple complex was to be a beacon of light, shining light, to show the message of the gospel that would have its fulfillment in me and his eventual, of course, Jesus' eventual cross and resurrection. And so what he's doing when he's clearing up the temple, he's going after insular, really unloving behavior, lazy religious hypocrisy. And so for those of you and those of us who love hypocrisy being called out, you're going to love the context of all this. You're going to love seeing especially religious people be called out for their hypocrisy. He also curses a fig tree. What did the fig tree ever do, right? But he does. He curses a fig tree. And what he's doing there, it's again, not just a concrete event he's doing. It's representing a parallel spiritual reality. He's cursing the fruitlessness of not just the temple, but those who are running the temple and treating it as a place to hide out, a den of robbers, a den of thieves. And so for those who love to see fruitlessness, religious fruitlessness that doesn't actually get anything done, that says a lot of things, that pontificates, but you like to see that called out, well, man, you are going to love this context, right? And then we also see that he gets into an argument not long after the events of today's text. And for those who love to see truth winning out and love to see falsity or falseness crushed, Jesus does that. And so you love this text because he calls out lies and he brings the truth to bear. But then he also gets in a conversation about those asking about the rightness or wrongness of paying taxes to the government, to Caesar. And he tells them, well, you know what? He is your governing authority. Pay him his taxes, something they didn't like. And so he went after basic human ethics for those who love common morality that we all share, not just of the Christian variety, but just the common morality we all share and ethics to be adhered to. They love Jesus calling out the fact that they need to just do what's right. Just do the right thing, right? What's so interesting, though, I say all that to say you cannot read what he is about to do without understanding his heart going into what he is about to do. See, many people love to just detail truth and crush lies. Love to tell people what the right thing is to do. Love to call out hypocrisy. Love to call out maybe fruitlessness or just not doing a lot of things. But do you also walk with the same heart as Christ walked with into those events? That's a serious question that I need to ask myself, a serious question that you need to ask yourself as well. All that being said, let's go to the actual text today. Luke 19, verse 41. As Jesus approached and saw the city, he wept for it. Now that alone is the money verse. That gives us an insight as to the frame of mind, the frame of heart that Jesus had walking into that city before he ever entered an argument, before he cleared any temple, before he cursed any fig tree, before he told anyone an unpopular message to just pay their taxes. He wept. He wept. This is our key verse for today. This passage gives us, nestled in between some fanfare and religious theater from the triumphal entry and all the events of that first Palm Sunday and some really aggressive words and actions on Jesus' part that would follow, this passage gives us a snapshot of Jesus' heart, his soul, his soul's interest in these people. In all of this, Jesus truly hurt for the people that the city of Jerusalem represented. He truly hurt deeply for them. And this comes out in his reaction. He wept for this community. More than this, the term for wept here means he literally burst into tears. He made a scene, folks. He's being lauded. He's being effectively worshipped, palm branches laid down as he enters on the back of a donkey. And he sees the city as he approaches. He just bursts out in tears. It's got to be a bit of an awkward moment for everyone there. It's a joyous scene. Like I said, religious fanfare, theater, really, because it would come up short eventually that the same cries for him and praises for him would eventually result in crucify him. So this religious theater, they had to have been somewhat confused by this bursting out in tears. Perhaps it may be best read, he openly and extremely emotionally lamented over this city. Like the laments of the prophet Jeremiah, this kind of weeping is a mix. It's not just one emotion. I mean, you know, when we cry, it's not usually just one emotion, and neither is this sudden bursting into tears. Much like Jeremiah, there was probably pain involved. An emotional pain. There's probably anger involved, of a good variety, a good anger, frustration. When someone is aware that another is rejecting the gospel, the good news, which is what the people of Jerusalem are doing, as we'll see in a minute. Only here, by the way, and in John 11:35, do we read of Jesus' weeping in the Gospels. No doubt he probably cried much more than this, but as far as just recorded history, recorded narrative, these are the only insights we get into what made Jesus cry. The irony is that in the spite of the great joy of the entry and the waving the palms, in spite of the city's grand beauty and decor during these festivals that were all beginning, he could only react with great weeping. Now, in a moment, we'll see clearly why his heart was moved to weep for this city. But first, I think it's just instructive to notice two small but not insignificant things that enabled Jesus to care at all about the people that were beginning to gather at Jerusalem for these festivals. First of all, it says, as he approached the city. I meant a minute ago that we've seen he was approaching Jerusalem several times. That is a fact. That is a concrete fact. But it is not a fact that is divorced from a grander reality. He approached the city, and to approach the city gave him tears for the city. Nothing is more dehumanizing than the pulpit of someone who is far removed from a people or a situation. The one that I continually hammer away on, and I will not stop hammering away on, is the pulpit of social media. It is incredibly dehumanizing to pulpiteer on social media so far removed from actual human beings and saying the kinds of things that we say about actual human beings. He was approaching the city. The closer he got physically to the city, the more he could not help but be moved and burst into tears. It is so dehumanizing to try, judge, and sentence, even condemn people from a Grand Canyon-like distance, to even have the kind of response Jesus had. You have to have a nearness mentality to people. You have to have a nearness mentality to people. If we desire to share anything of Jesus' heart for the people of our community, we have to be near and amongst the people of our city. If I could just say this strongly, spend less time on your phone and spend more time with people. Spend less time on your phone and spend more time with people. Again, distance breeds contempt. Nearness breeds at least interest and potential for concern. He not only approached the city, but it says he saw it. Saw it. He didn't just see it as in he saw the skyline. He saw the view. He saw it for what it was. He saw it. He saw it as not just a city, but a collection, a gathering of people. Individual people, all created by God. He saw it and saw it as more than a city. Again, there's just nothing more dehumanizing than being mistook and misunderstood as a human being. You and I, we can be so relationally lazy and in so much of a hurry so often that we miss what people are actually saying and ultimately who they really are. My family can probably verify this, but if there's one thing that gets me pretty flustered and frustrated pretty quick, it's when I start to say something or express myself in some way, and then I get cut off and my sentence gets finished for me. Or I get cut off and a word of response is given to me. Very much frustrates me because I don't feel like I was allowed to finish my statement. Let me finish. Let me finish what I'm saying. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever feel like people read your email and then they respond to a question you never asked them? Do you ever get that? I've done this to people, and I've had this done to me. These are just but small examples of just being relationally lazy with other human beings, not listening, not paying attention, not really seeing them. Nothing more frustrating than being a wallflower, basically just being a part of the scenery of people's lives, but not being heard or even seen by other people. Jesus didn't just see the city, he saw the people of it. He understood the people of it. Even the fact that these people largely had rejected him, which we're going to get onto here in the next verses. Let's continue on. As he approached and saw the city, he wept for it, saying this, "If you, city, the people of the city, if you knew this day and what would bring peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." So here we have the beginning of really three things today's text is going to teach us about Jesus' heart, the heart that was moved to tears for his community and its people. If we want to have the kind of heart that before we exercise truth, before we establish curses on fig trees, before we get in a tizzy about dehumanized hypocrisy within religion and call out bad behavior for what it is, maybe let's pay attention to the heart of Jesus going into this. Here we see one of the first things about his heart. If your heart, if my heart is unmoved or apathetic or maybe just lukewarm about my larger community and its people, let's learn from Jesus. The first thing is this. They had to this point at least, they had rejected their opportunities to respond to the gospel. What this text actually calls peace, that they had rejected peace. And peace in this text is just a fill-in or a stand-in for the larger implications of the gospel message. It would bring peace for them to have received the gospel message, but they have rejected peace by rejecting the gospel message. Jesus rightly says that it is simply hidden from their eyes at this point, and that grieves him greatly that it's hidden from their eyes. Why? Because Jesus is incredibly acquainted with the grace of God and how the gospel message is not just good news, but unbelievably fantastic. fantastic news for anyone that would want to receive it. I mean, just crazy good news. As God himself in the flesh, he knows that this news is unbelievably fantastic news for anyone to hear it. So much so that people rejecting it to this point could not help but affect his heart. The degree to which you and I understand the beauty of God's message of grace in the gospel at any given moment, any given season, will determine the degree to which we are unhinged over the devastation of anyone rejecting it. Chances are, if the grace of God isn't, if it's not just not good news, but just kind of okay news to us, there are chances we will never weep for our cities. Because if it's okay news, then we are probably okay that many reject it. But if it is absolutely fantastic news, then it is crushing to us. Crushing to us. Weep worthy that those who would reject it. A lot of times early on when I became a Christian, I was immature, of course, in many ways. One of the ways that immaturity came out, I knew the gospel was fantastically good news, but I missed just how good a news it was. Could not see the forest for the trees when I would tell others about the gospel, because in that moment that I was rejected, instead of thinking about, they've just rejected the most amazing news, I was usually upset because I felt like they rejected me. They rejected the news that I, and this is so subtle, folks, but this is actually the reason why I was incapable for many years to even weep for anyone or to have the kind of weep-worthy heart for communities, whole groups of people, because I took it as rejection of me instead of understanding the rejection. Because rejecting me isn't rejecting good news, right? You've just rejected something that I consider important. But if I really feel the weight of what they've rejected, as opposed to them rejecting me, I would have a completely different heart about it and approaching them. So, okay, so let's continue on. That's the first thing. Second thing's next. As he approached, he saw the city. He wept for it, saying, "If you knew this day that would bring peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. For the days will come on you when your enemies will build a barricade around you, surround you, and hem you in on every side." Now, this is precisely what he is describing here. This is precisely the method that was used by Titus when he laid siege to Jerusalem in AD 70. He barricaded the city, hemmed them in, surrounded it on April 9th, AD 70, cutting off all supplies, trapping thousands of people who had been in Jerusalem for the Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it wasn't just trapping the existing city as it stood in any given date. It was on the date during the time and season in which the most amount of people would have been gathered into the city, and he trapped them inside of it, laying siege to the city. The Romans held the city in this manner throughout the summer, defeating various sections of it, one by one, throughout the city. And the final overthrow of the city occurred in early September of that year. So what Jesus is saying actually, in concrete terms, actually happened. But remember, this is more than simply a detailed account of Jesus and his approach to Jerusalem and what will eventually happen to this city. There are sweeping spiritual parallels that are meant to be perceived by his hearers here. That leads us to the second thing we need to understand about what was the motivation or the heart behind Jesus' tears, and it is this. Jesus understood that the people of Jerusalem were not merely barricaded and hemmed in by the future siege of Titus and the Romans, but they were barricaded and hemmed in by their willing spiritual enslavement. They were willingly spiritually enslaved by their fears. They had great fears over being a subjugated people of the Roman government. And as such, even that is an integral part of why they crucified Christ. They felt he was a rebel and would soon cause the kind of scene and get the kind of attention that you don't want from Rome, that would eventually land a legion of troops on their doorstep ready to lay siege to the city. Ironically, in their way of trying to avoid all that, they actually opened up the way and welcomed all that. It was ultimately the rejection of Jesus that led to the real enemy coming in and destroying them. What is being painted in this narrative was that the people of Jerusalem had willingly chosen to remain in utter enslavement. And that absolutely, it pained Jesus. It pained Jesus to see people continually act in a way of grand comfort in their own enslavement. Enemies will build barricade against our souls. The enemy will. He will enslave us, oftentimes saying, that thing you fear, I'll give you an escape route for your fears. And ironically, the escape route always ends in enslavement once again. He never tells the truth. He always lies. And he always gives you in a way out that seems appealing at the moment, but in the end, lands you in the enslavement you were already in the first place. And he will hem you in on every side. It pained Jesus, and no doubt in some good ways angered Jesus and frustrated Jesus that these people were enslaved to the enemy. So his heart was broken by this, and so he wept because he understood the nature of their enslavement. The final thing we want to see comes out of verse 44. Let's go ahead and read it, the whole section in total. As he approached and saw the city, he wept for it, saying, "If you knew this day, what would bring peace? But now it is hidden from your eyes. For the day will come when you and your enemies will build a barricade around you, surround you, and hem you in on every side. Then they will crush you and your children among you to the ground, and they will not leave one stone on another in your midst, because you did not recognize the time when God visited you." Tear you down. This literally was fulfilled. The Romans, not long after the siege, demolished the city. They demolished the temple. They demolished the residences. They crushed the human population, men, women, and children. Many were brutally slaughtered by the tens of thousands. It literally was one of the many holocausts of the people of Jerusalem. The few survivors that were left were carried off to become victims of the Roman circus games and gladiatorial bouts. It was brutal what transpired to them. Utter destruction. Again, this is not simply a transcription of concrete events, but concrete events that paint a picture, a brutal spiritual reality that caused Jesus to weep. Utter destruction, represented by the toppling over and almost elimination of the city of Jerusalem for a period of time, was representative of the end game of the enemy for my soul and yours. And that is hell. That is commiseration with his end, joining him in his eternal ugliness. I don't know what you think of when you think of hell, but it is actually kind of important to understand the full breadth of it. I think oftentimes we think of the imageries that we get in popular culture, maybe even from some of Dante's works on the subject. maybe even some good authors. I know that there's been some good writings from some of our modern theologians on hell and its nature. C.S. Lewis wrote on it. It's important to think about the full breadth of what the implications of hell are, because we can kind of caricaturize it as just this place where a mean guy in a red pajama outfit continually pokes us with a spear, and that kind of caricaturizes it, and it makes it kind of one-dimensional and almost cartoonish. But it's important to think through this, because Jesus, again, is paralleling the spiritual nature of what is going to transpire to Jerusalem, and that is causing him to weep. It causes him to weep and have great compassion and concern and care for this city that he is approaching. And so hell, for us, cannot be simply one-dimensional. It's not simply about pain in a physically destructive sense. I'm sure there's plenty of that, but also in every other sense. I don't know if you've thought about hell this way, but think about it this way. Hell's the place where you get everything you want. Some of you are going, well, that don't sound so bad. Everything you want that is selfish, hedonistically pays no attention to others. Hell's a place where not only you get all you want, but so does everyone else that's in hell. They get what they want. Now, let's just think logically for just a moment. What would it look like in today's world if every one of us got everything that we wanted? Every one of us. Let's exercise that and just say, let's all the worst things we want, all of our worst thoughts we want, and all of us got it. What would that be? Someone just said chaos. Can I give you another word? Hell. It would be hell, which is chaos, which is horror, which is Stephen King times a million. You know, Chucky and Pet Sematary have nothing on hell, folks. Serious. They have nothing on it. Every horror film you ever saw is but a caricature of hell, a cartoon of hell. We ultimately get what we want, all of us. And when a society of people that all are allowed to seek and pursue what they want without exception, without hindrance, the results are devastating and destructive. There's nothing worse than people getting the worst of all they want. And hell is the place where God gives you that. He gives you everything you want, all the worst things you ever want. And let you sit in it for eternity. This moves Jesus to weep for Jerusalem. Friends, if we want to have something of a heart for the people and the city and the community in which we live in, it would do well to just maybe spend the next week reading Jesus's weeping and approaching Jerusalem and reminding ourselves of all the varieties of reasons he was weeping. They had rejected the best news on the planet. They had chosen willingly enslavement, and that struck Jesus to the core. They had chosen willingly to march to the destructiveness and the chaos of getting all that they wanted. And he could not help but weep for them. It is as unchristian a response as there can be to see people willingly marching themselves into hell's gates and being gleeful about it. God is not. Jesus was not. He wept for people. He desired so much better for them than he knew they desired for themselves. Would that we would have that heart.